Today is Thursday, July 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee is set to vote today on whether to authorize issuing subpoenas to current and former Trump administration and campaign officials. The U.N. Human Rights Council will investigate alleged violations in the Philippines' war on drugs.
First, but very critical step towards accountability for the thousands of victims.
And how ride-hailing company Uber is considering expanding to Senegal's capital of Dakar. Those stories and more are coming up on today's International Edition. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee is set to vote later today on whether to authorize issuing subpoenas to current and former Trump administration and campaign officials as part of investigations into obstruction of justice, corruption, and the administration's policies of separating families and detaining children at the southern border. Joining me on the phone is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So, Catherine, what can you tell us about the vote that's slated to take place later today?
Well, I can tell you that it was certainly a morning of fireworks in the House Judiciary Committee, as it seems to be all the time these days now. A lot of debate about these subpoenas and about whether really the House Democratic leadership should have pursued this avenue of inquiry. They argue that this is an important fact-finding investigation, that this is part of their broader mandate to investigate the Trump administration on behalf of the American people, to hold them to account for possible abuses of power, possible financial conflicts of interest, and also, of course, about the situation at the border. Meanwhile, Republicans say that this is yet another attempt to revive the Mueller investigation, which they say has already been closed.
So I take it that we expect the vote on the committee to be straight down party lines. What does that mean moving forward?
Yes, that's right. So what that means is that likely we do know that, of course, because it's by party lines, that means it does pass. It is authorized. Now, the bigger question is whether or not these former and current White House administration officials will comply with those subpoenas. Some of them have already expressed interest in so-called friendly subpoenas, which means that they would basically negotiate their testimony with Chairman Nadler and that they could somehow work out a deal. But I would not expect some of the bigger names here, like Jared Kushner, to be immediately complying with those subpoenas.
Are we looking at, if they do honor the subpoenas, those who are going to be issued them, is the committee looking for open door or closed door testimony or a combination of the two?
That's something of the negotiations that go on in terms of a friendly subpoena. They can, you know, have a closed door testimony and then release the transcript. That's happened with Hope Hicks, some of the other administration officials. They can work that out as they go along and go through this process.
Another issue that Speaker Pelosi mentioned is that she may at some time, quote unquote, soon bring to the floor a vote on vote for criminal conduct for AG Barr and so forth. Do we have any information about that, seeing as how the House is getting ready to go out for recess?
Right. You make a very good point, is that they have a dwindling number of days, 10 legislative days, actually, to wrap up what is quite a lot of work in terms of investigations into the Trump administration and legislative work. Speaker Pelosi just announced this morning that they will hold those contempt votes, and it looks like we'll be holding those next Tuesday, which gives Democrats a little bit of time to play with.
All right. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Britain said on Thursday that Iranian vessels tried to impede the passage of a British oil tanker through the Strait of Hormuz. A government statement said three Iranian vessels were involved with the incident and that they backed off when they received a warning from a British warship. Iran's Revolutionary Guards denied Britain's accusation. A statement carried by the semi-official Fars news agency said guards patrol boats carried out normal duties and had no clashes with alien boats, especially English boats. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani had warned Wednesday that Britain would face unspecified consequences over the seizure last week of an Iranian oil tanker suspected of transporting oil to Syria in violation of sanctions. The U.S. Central Command said threats to international freedom of navigation require an international solution. The world economy depends on the free flow of commerce, and it is incumbent on all nations to protect and preserve this linchpin of global prosperity. The Strait of Hormuz is a strategic waterway through which much of the oil in the Middle East is transported. Here are some other major stories from around the globe. U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has defended his actions more than a decade ago as a federal prosecutor in agreeing to a light jail sentence for billionaire hedge fund manager Jeffrey Epstein, who was accused in a child sex trafficking case. Conservative groups are heading to the White House on Thursday to discuss how to deal with reports and stories from social media, but social media giants Twitter and Facebook will not be there. The Cambodian government is abolishing a controversial hotel prison project, that according to the Ministry of Interior officials. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on our VOA.news, VOAnews.com website, and on our mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to an international group of researchers, coral reefs are moving away from tropical waters near the equator and are heading for the more moderate conditions of the subtropics. Those are findings included in a recent study published in the journal Marine Ecology Progress Series. Study evidence finds that for over the last 40 years, the number of young corals who make their homes on tropical reefs near the equator has dropped by 85%, but have doubled on reefs in the subtropics. Study lead author Nicole Price from the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences in East Boothbay, Maine, says climate change appears to be relocating coral reefs in a way that it has done with other marine species. She added scientists still don't know if these new reefs can support the wide range of species that have long lived in the tropical systems. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Japan has put on a new limit to the export of high-tech materials to South Korea, a move that could potentially affect the world's supply of smartphones. Reuters' Grace Lee reports that it all started with a dispute over compensation for wartime laborers.
These South Koreans are protesting against Japan's new export limits. The two countries are in the middle of a spiraling fight over trade, and pretty soon, it might affect the whole world supply of smartphones. But to understand what's happening here, you need to know a little bit of history. The issue goes all the way back to World War II. Japan colonized the Korean Peninsula around that time, and that came with the forced labor of Korean workers, along with the use of comfort women, another touchy subject. It's a euphemism for girls and women who were forced to work in wartime brothels. Recently, South Korea wanted to make a joint fund for the labor victims and asked Japan for contributions from its companies. A South Korean court last year ruled that Japan's Nippon Steel and Mitsubishi Heavy owed hundreds of thousands of dollars to Korean plaintiffs. Kim Sung-ju was one of them. She was sent to Japan by a Japanese teacher.
I decided to go there to study. However, when I got there, there was no opportunity to study. I had to go straight to a factory and work.
Tokyo refused to pay. Instead, it threatened to slap limits on high-tech materials sent to South Korea, parts that are critical for making smartphones and memory chips. When that was announced last week, there was outrage in South Korea and calls to boycott all Japanese products. A few days ago, representatives from Tokyo and Seoul met face-to-face during a meeting at the World Trade Organization. South Korea said it would raise the issue with the WTO, while Japan argued that it didn't violate any WTO rules. It even threatened more measures against South Korea. South Korean President Moon Jae-in says it's possible the situation could drag on.
We're going to ramp up spending to help Korean firms source parts, materials, and equipment at home instead.
Pretty soon, this will mean trouble not just for South Korea, but for the rest of the world too. The export limits will hit tech giants like Samsung and SK Hynix. They're the world's top memory chip makers and supply both Apple and China's Huawei. But so far, both sides haven't shown any signs of backing down. And they're both U.S. allies, so Washington's been roped into it too. South Korea's foreign minister spoke to Secretary of State Pompeo on Wednesday, warning that Japan's actions could ultimately hurt U.S. companies. Pompeo reportedly said he wants to try and strengthen communication between all three sides. Time is ticking, though. Japan's export restrictions will kick in about 90 days.
That was Reuters reporter Grace Lee. A UN report on extensive human rights violations in the Russian-backed separatist regions of eastern Ukraine and in the Russian-annexed Crimean Peninsula has triggered a fiery debate at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The slow simmering conflict between Russian-backed rebels and the Ukrainian government in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk is entering its sixth year. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Kate Gilmore says 5 million people are directly affected by ongoing hostilities along the contact line, the area that separates the two warring forces.
Shelling, use of small arms and light weapons, mines, explosive remnants of war. These continue to kill and injure civilian women and men, girls and boys.
So far this year, she says 13 people have been killed and 78 injured. Gilmore says people in the rebel-controlled areas also suffer from extreme poverty because they do not receive their pensions from the government in Kiev. She criticizes the self-proclaimed authorities in eastern Ukraine for denying human rights monitors access to detainees. She says many have been subject to torture. She also accuses the Russian Federation of violations of international human rights and humanitarian law in Crimea, which Russia illegally annexed in March 2014.
Those who criticize the occupation or advocate broadly for human rights are intimidated, even imprisoned. Crimean Tatars have been subjected to arrest, convictions for affiliation with Muslim groups declared as extremist organizations under Russian law.
Following Gilmore's statement, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Yuri Klimenko, lashed out at Russia's occupation of Crimea. He accused the Kremlin of violating international humanitarian law in support of the separatists in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine.
The temporary occupied territories of the Donetsk and Lugansk regions, as well as in Crimea, Russia stubbornly imposes its citizenships on the local population, thus violating the norms of international humanitarian law and the sovereignty of Ukraine. Russia has not come to Donbas to protect anyone. Russia, as an aggressor state, has come to kill.
Ukraine's criticisms did not sit well with the Russian representative at the council. Second Secretary at the Russian mission to the UN in Geneva, Kristina Sukacheva, sneered at Ukraine's efforts to blame Russia for all violations in the Donbas and Crimea. She called these accusations unsubstantiated and farcical. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has agreed to set up a preliminary UN investigation into thousands of killings in the Philippines' so-called war on drugs. A spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office said in a statement to VOA, quote, "The resolution on the human rights situation in the Philippines and its request for a comprehensive written report is an opportunity for all stakeholders, including the government, to assess the current state of human rights in the country and in particular to get clarity around the contested facts, figures, and circumstances." End quote. For more, I spoke earlier with Human Rights Watch's Deputy United Nations Director, Leila Matar. I began our conversation by asking her to put the announcement into context.
So what this adoption of the resolution really means is a first but very critical step towards accountability for the thousands of victims in the Philippines of President Duterte's so-called war on drugs, but also against any critic, really, human rights defenders and journalists who have criticized this war on drugs and who have therefore also been harassed or threatened and arrested. And this resolution means we'll have a report on the human rights situation, a formal report at the UN, and that is a very important step towards future accountability for those violations.
The Philippines actually put forward a very vigorous information campaign to try and dissuade people from voting in favor of it. What do you anticipate Duterte and the Philippine administration doing now that the resolution has passed?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, what they put forward was a misinformation campaign. In fact, of my 7 or so years working in the Human Rights Council space, I've never seen such a vicious outreach to try to block a resolution by any state. Of course, we are concerned about what Philippines in general can do towards its own citizens. We've seen that there's much to be feared, and we certainly hope that the Philippines will take this resolution as a message that it needs to curb its violations. And that we won't see any negative consequences or reprisals as a basis on the basis of this resolution. But I also want to add that in the statement by the ambassador delivered at the end of the adoption of the resolution today, the Philippines made what is, could definitely be characterized as threats against those who had advocated for this important resolution.
In what way? What did they say?
Basically, he said that there would be consequences for those that had supported this resolution. Now, that can be interpreted in various ways, but having seen how the Philippines has behaved against its critics ever since President Duterte took power, I think there is cause for concern, and the international community should watch very closely to make sure that those that are fighting for rights and justice in the Philippines are protected in the aftermath of the resolution.
Duterte and the administration have said that the killings are not extrajudicial, that these are criminals, that they have violated the law, and the police are just simply carrying out their duties. Human Rights Watch has conducted some research in the area. What are your findings?
Right. So, I mean, there are legitimate and legal ways of trying to curb drug use or drug trade in a country. There are many health-based approaches. There are international standards. The way the Philippines are conducting their anti-drug campaign is not one of them. What we have seen, and this is well documented, is on a daily basis, ongoing till this day, killings of some of the poorest and most marginalized people, not just in Manila, but also urban areas around the country. Our reporting shows that there is evidence that the police often manufactures evidence, basically planting guns or weapons or planting drugs on victims to justify the killings. But what we hear from so many witnesses is that these are flat-out executions, and that it's not true what the police says, that all of these people have resisted arrest. And it's important to remember that, you know, by the Philippines' own admission, more than 6,000 people have been killed, and they claim that all of these have resisted arrest. But again, as Human Rights Watch, the National Human Rights Commission of the Philippines itself, and so many other activists show, this is really just part of their misinformation campaign.
Duterte hasn't exactly embraced United Nations personnel coming in to conduct investigations into this topic and others. What challenges face in carrying out their investigation leading up to the report that's due out next year?
I mean, this is, to speak to your question, part of the reason this resolution was so important is that because if it had failed, it would basically have rewarded non-cooperation by the Philippines, which, by the way, is a member of the Human Rights Council, because they've been quite hostile to UN experts that have either tried to visit or that have criticized what they have done. So, of course, we can expect, though we hope to be wrong, that the Philippines might be resistant to the Office of the High Commissioner, which has now been tasked with producing a report to be presented next year, from coming into the country, getting unhindered access, guaranteeing the protection of those that they speak with. But of course, we hope that this important step, this resolution, will compel the Philippines to collaborate and cooperate with the international community in a way that it is vehemently refused to do so far. I mean, I do think it's just important for everyone to hear that what really happened at the UN Human Rights Council today is that those who want justice really prevailed in the face of the Philippines and other state perpetrators of human rights banding together and bullying others to try to convince them against the resolution. So this is really a victory for those principled countries.
And that was Leila Matar, the Deputy United Nations Director for Human Rights Watch. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, after months of violent protests in Sudan, a preliminary power-sharing agreement has been negotiated between the Forces for Democratic Change and the Transitional Military Council. Sudan in transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Authorities in Greece say seven people are dead after a violent storm hit the northern part of the country late Wednesday. Winds reported up to 100 kilometers per hour. The storm then ripped rooftops off homes, uprooted trees, and overturned vehicles on Greek's Chalkidiki Peninsula. Witnesses say the storm only lasted a matter of minutes. A state of emergency has been declared in the popular summer tourist location. Authorities say two of those killed were tourists who died when winds overturned their vehicle, while a mother and her 8-year-old boy were killed when a restaurant roof collapsed as a result from the storm. In addition, we have a story. Two bomb-laden vehicles exploded Thursday near a group of Libyan National Army leaders in their eastern stronghold of Benghazi, killing four people and wounding 33 others, and casting doubt on the LNA's 3-month-old offensive on Tripoli. Ride-hailing company Uber is considering expanding to Senegal's capital of Dakar. But as VOA's Issa Shirai explains, in a city full of taxis and drivers without smartphones, the San Francisco-based company faces a number of obstacles.
In most parts of Dakar, at any time of the day, it's easy to find transportation as taxi drivers compete for business. But Uber is considering taking its services to the city. According to Francesca Uriri, Uber's head of communications in West Africa, the company is aspiring to be everywhere.
And this means that any progressive, forward-thinking city which has a need for safe, reliable, and efficient transportation is essentially where we want to be. We are part of a broader mobility movement in establishing smart cities of the future, and we'll continue to explore these options in West Africa.
But Uber, which operates via smartphone app, will have to overcome many challenges to work in Dakar, including contending with a lack of fixed addresses. Sagone, a Dakar resident who recently traveled to New York and used Uber while there, says much will have to change before the company can operate successfully in Dakar.
It might work here, but it will require lots of investment because we don't have the same organization as in US. Like when you are coming to my house, I will not be able to tell you exactly where my house is located on the map. So you will have to, you know, I will have to tell you a building or somewhere, a school, somewhere I can pick you from.
With most taxi services in Dakar, riders and drivers must negotiate prices first. Some drivers say they would be happier with a fixed price based on mileage and time. Gora Sen has been a taxi driver since 1998. Sen says he is open to the idea of Uber establishing a presence in Dakar. He says that he thinks Uber could do well in Dakar if the company works with local drivers who know the city and have experience driving there. Uber currently operates in 23 cities in Africa. In West Africa, Uber has a presence only in Ghana and Nigeria. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Dakar.
And if we take a quick look back in time, it was on this date in 1859 that Big Ben, the great bell inside the famous London clock tower, chimed for the very first time. In 1914, Babe Ruth made his Major League Baseball debut, pitching for the Boston Red Sox in a 4-3 victory over Cleveland. And in 1979, the United States abandoned the space station Skylab, which made a spectacular return to Earth, burning up in the atmosphere and showering debris over the Indian Ocean and Australia. And that's going to do it for me today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, engineer Sidrak Franklin, and managing editor, Paul Alexander, thank you so much for joining us. Now for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on social media. You'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a tremendous Thursday.